The second scripture passage for today is from the beginning of the book of Isaiah. And it's a story about a garden, too. Sort of relates to that first passage we read, the famous passage about the Garden of Eden in Genesis. But listen what God said. Listen to what God says about this particular garden. Let me sing for the vineyard a love song. The beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. God dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. And God, the beloved, built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, for God expected it to yield grapes. But in fact, it yielded wild grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I had not done in it? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield these sour grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do with this vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but will be overgrown with briars and thorns, and the rain shall not fall on it. For the vineyard of God is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are God's pleasant planting. And where God expected justice, God saw bloodshed. And where God expected righteousness, he heard the voice of crying. Stories of gardens. They're all over the garden. They're all over the Bible, I should say. They're all over the Bible from the beginning to the end. At the beginning of the Bible, remember, we have this famous story of the Garden of Eden. At the end of the Bible, we have the story of the renewed world, where there's healing that is springing forth from the stream that runs in that garden. And the tree, once you eat of that tree, you have life everlasting. This is a vision of the garden restored. But throughout the Bible, we have all sorts of different images of gardens, too. And, you know, I mentioned at children's chat this whole idea of sowing and reaping. We have, when Paul is writing to the church at Galatia, he talks about the fruits of the Spirit. So the image of the garden is applied to a lot of different spheres in the Bible. In Genesis chapter 1, we see this image of world as garden. The world is a garden. And the call of humankind was to, it says in the New Revised Standard Version, till it and keep it. If we think of world and this planet as garden, what does it mean to till it and keep it? It's interesting the different translations of that phrase. I think in the NIV it says work it and keep it. In the Contemporary English Version it says take care of it and preserve it. And in the old King James Version, which I grew up with, and maybe many of you grew up with too, there's a phrase that resounds in my head. Do you all remember what that phrase was? Tend it and keep it. Tend it and keep it. So the idea of world care as garden tending is set out for us here in Genesis chapter 1. Our obligation to the earth is to protect it, to honor its limits and its bounds, and then to nurture it. That is to make of it the best that it can be, given those limits and bounds. Whole earth is like a garden. But then, you know, we have these images of personal lives, our personal lives being like gardens. Paul says, what you sow, you're going to reap. Your life is kind of like a garden that way. Or he insists we can nurture certain things in our garden, like the fruits of the Spirit, joy, love, peace, goodness, kindness, patience, and all those things that we see as component virtues of compassion. You know, each one of those is precious in and of itself, like a petal on the rose, but all of them put together make a life of care. And growing that rose of compassion is an important part of what it means to be human. So personal lives are kind of like gardens. But then you have in this passage in Isaiah the social sphere being like a garden, the immediate social context of a people. And God says in this passage some very interesting things about this garden that God has planted and expected certain things from, and then they didn't show up. So it's kind of interesting. As you hear this sermon today, I'm going to invite you to tune out if you want to. This might be the only time I say that this year, so appreciate this chance. I'm giving you tune out if you want to, because the image of the garden is so broad, it can be applied to so many different areas of life. I want you to just to apply it to whatever area of life you feel like you want to apply it to as we go through these characteristics of garden tending this morning and see how it works. So if you want to let your mind wander and think about what I'm saying here as applying to personal transformation, then do that. Or if you want to think about it in terms of social system transformation, then go ahead and do that. Or if you want to think about it in terms of world care and what it would mean for world care, then go ahead and do that. But all these things have in common this idea of tending, that life is a garden that needs to be tended, that we have obligations to take care of it. And as I look at this text, I realize that I had extra strong feelings about this year, because I myself have two gardens. I have one over at 6th Street Gardens in Newark, and I have a garden over here at the Granville Garden. And actually, you know, I was reading this text today is a lectionary text. That means, you know, it's a standard text that a lot of Protestant churches use to preach from in the morning. And so as I was reading the text this week, I realized, oh, well, I've been gardening this year too. And it reminded me that my gardens this year have really been a flop. They have completely... these potatoes that I showed the kids, I didn't want to share with them the full story, but I think that I got fewer potatoes out of the ground than what I put in this year. That was really sad. 5 rows of potatoes. I think we got maybe 1 grocery sack full out of 5 rows. It was just a complete disaster. And so as I was reading those things about God's tending of the garden, I was thinking to myself about my own gardening and how true this stuff really is, even if you take it at the basic literal level. And if you look in this text, for example, there's some characteristics of God's garden tending and what it means to tend a garden here. And the first one you can see in this Isaiah chapter 5 text is that in order to raise a good garden, in order to tend it well, you need some intentionality. There has to be intentionality. And so you see here that God planted a vineyard, and he chose a very fertile hill. It says a very fertile hill. God chose to put it in a very fertile hill with choice vines, right? I built it with choice vines. And what did he put there in the middle of the garden? And it said, and I dug myself out a wine vat. You can tell that God's coming to the gardening process with some intentionality. Here's what I want to get out of the garden. Wine. And in order to get wine, I need good ground, and I need good vines, and I need a wine press. And so there's a purpose and a vision. This is what I want out of my garden. I'm going to do these things that are necessary in order to get this result. And whenever we think about tending garden, isn't that true of all of us? We have to have some intentionality. These are the results I want to get. And one of my big mistakes this year in one of my gardens was that I did not practice the art of intentionality. I only had one day. I had to get a garden in one day. And so I throw a bunch of seeds at the back of my car, you know. And I run to the garden and pull up all the weeds that I could and dug up everything I could, and then I just started planting. Wacka, 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 row by row by row by row. It was a little too early for a lot of the things I planted, first of all, but I only had this one day to do it, and so I was going to get it in there. By the time I get to the end of the garden, I realize I've got this big bags of potatoes to put into the ground, and phooey, I'm planting them right over top of where I planted them last year. But by this time, I've gotten everything in the ground. I can't rotate it. I've got no choice. I've got to plant them over where I planted them last year. And because of that, my potatoes were growing in soil that had already been potatoed out, right? Intentionality. I needed a little bit of intentionality, but it just wasn't there. It was a flop. And in the political and social sphere, it's the same thing. I mean, if we're going to grow a vineyard, if the world is going to be this vineyard, this garden that produces the fruits of peace, shalom, if we have shalom in the garden, if we have peace, the peace that comes from right relationship in the garden, we've got to have a vision for what that looks like. And in the social and political sphere, it's important for us to vision what we want out of the world before we start trying to do our gardening work. And this is really interesting. One theologian says traditional theology, if you pick up a book of theology, traditionally it's been written, and it starts out with the nature and characteristics of God, and it goes through the nature of the church, and what sin means, what is humanity, and blah, 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 all the way to the end. And in the end is eschatology, things to come. And he said, this is completely backwards. When we write a theology, really what we should do is start the first volume being eschatology, what is to come. What am I looking for? What kind of world do we want? And if we don't know what kind of world that we want, if we can't even envision what a world of right relationship would actually look like, it's going to be really hard to get that out of the ground. If we don't know what seeds to plant, who knows what's going to come up? Because we haven't really thought about it. And so intentionality and vision is important. In the personal sphere, do we know what a life at peace would be? What peace in our own lives would look like? And have we really thought about what we're going to do? What sort of efforts would be necessary in order to gain that peace that comes from right relationship? And we have a deficit of this in our culture, I think. So many of us are so busy, just like me. I had one day to put that garden in. I was just going to flop it in there, you know. We're so busy running around in totabatashite, we say in Japanese. You can't focus on any one thing, and you're trying to just do anything that you can to survive, and we forget about, wow, maybe I'm not doing this very intentionally, and maybe my results are less than adequate because I'm not really taking the time to think about it. I read a book early on in our married life called The Intentional Family. Now, I wouldn't have written this book the same way it's written, but there's a lot of good stuff in here. And what this author says, William Dougherty, he's a counselor, family counselor, is that we have a deficit in America of intentionality in terms of family lives. We get so busy doing everything we feel like we need to do, we haven't really sat down and thought about, what do I want my family to look like? And what would it be necessary for me to do in order to make that happen? Maybe it means making a commitment. We're going to have meals together X times a week, and everything else is going to be pushed away as much as possible so that we can get that time together. Or I'm going to sit down and do homework with my elementary age child so that he or she understands that 30 minutes a night. And we make these decisions because we have a certain kind of vision that we want to implement. Or I'm going to make it a priority to go on a date with my partner, you know, once a month, or reality, once every 6 months. Okay, so something like that, you know. Be a little intentional and think, what do I want out of this? So how am I going to have to plan in order to do it? And that's part of gardening. Part of tending the garden is to look ahead. Are we as churches doing this? Many churches, you know, just go through the motions. They don't really ask the big questions sometimes. You go to some churches and you really don't know what they're trying to grow. What are they trying to make? You know, we need to decide. We're going to make wine. And to make wine, we need good soil, good plants, and a wine vat. Churches are the same way. We need to decide, what are we about? And if we're about this, what are we going to do in order to make that happen? Intentionality. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And then the second thing that you see in this passage about growing a garden is effort. At the very beginning, it says, the beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill, and God dug it and cleared it of stones. Now, this is before, you know, the rototillers, those nice kinds that are weighted so that the back is where the tiller is, and you can just chug along. This is back in the day when people are digging things up with very crude instruments. He dug it and cleared it of stones. Can you imagine the sweat involved? Well, I can imagine it because I didn't have a tiller. And at the 6th Street Garden and at the Granville Garden, I actually did have to take the shovel and turn the thing over little piece by piece, you know, and chop it up with my hoe and take the rocks and put them away and this and that and the other. It's work. It's effort. If you're going to grow a garden, guess what? It takes effort. It takes work. And nobody wants to hear that, least of all me. And that's why my garden was a flop this year. It's really, I didn't put much effort into it. If you went out and you looked at my garden, you'd see there's weeds all over this place because I didn't put the effort in that was necessary in order to get those weeds out. It's a lot of work. And I was reading earlier on, I know there's a lot of debate about this, but Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote a book called Outliers, how many of you read that? It was a pretty popular, popular airplane book, where he's, you know, one of those books that you get at the airplane stands and read them, turn them in at the end. You don't do that? And the thesis of this book was that geniuses really are overrated, that really anybody can do almost anything if you put enough work into it. And so he popularized this 10,000-hour rule. If you put 10,000 hours of work into anything, you can be a pro. You know, if you put 10,000 hours of work into ice hockey, you're going to be a good ice hockey player. If you put $10,000 of work into playing the hours of work into playing the violin, you're going to be a violin player, you know? And it's just about the effort you put in. Now, people have come along afterwards and calmed him down a little bit. Wait a minute. You know, certain people are geared to do certain things, and that's obviously true. Certain people are geared to do certain things, and certain people can do certain things a lot easier than other people can do them. But sometimes we don't emphasize enough the importance of effort. It just takes showing up and doing the work day after day after day after day. And it's hard work. If we think about this in the political and social sphere, if we want to raise a garden of shalom, politically and socially, if we want our world to look like a world of shalom, then we have to just get out there and do the work. If we say we want better transportation, if we say we want less gun violence, if we say we want fewer nuclear weapons, if we say we want more renewable energy, we can't just sit around and hope that that happens. We've got to go do work. We've got to show up at rallies. We've got to write letters. We've got to be involved in the political process. We've got to mobilize people. We've got to work. It's uncomfortable. I don't like work. It causes sweat. That's why I quit CrossFit. You know? But in order to...
Jerry's looking at me. Convicting stare.
We don't like work, but it takes work to grow a garden. You know? It takes work. And we know this in the personal sphere. Think about the amount of work a parent, if you have a family, if you know people with families, parents put into making ends meet for their families. It's an enormous amount of work to assure that their families are raised up well and have the things that they need. The amount of time that's spent as parents stay up night after night with crying or sick children, the investment psychologically and physically is enormous. It's difficult work. And if you have a child with special needs, how much more so? Or partners sitting for days and days in the hospital with each other as the other is ill. How much work that is, an effort. And yet, in order to grow the garden of peace in our lives, we gotta put it in. There's no way around. There's no easy solution. The work just has to be done. We have to sometimes even sacrifice. And I think of this in the church realm, too. Think about churches. People think somehow that churches just exist. And so I could just show up, and there will be a church, and I go away and show up when I like, and it'll just still exist and go away when I like. Guess what? It doesn't work that way. There's church. Did you hear about 15,000 churches a year in this country are shutting down? About 15,000 a year. Why? Because people aren't showing up and doing the work. If churches don't have the financial resources in order to maintain the witness that the church wants to maintain, the church is going to shut itself down. If there are not people resources, who won't come and say, hey, I'm going to make sure that children are cared for at this church, and I'm going to do my part in that area. Or other people say, I'm going to make sure that, you know, the heating and air conditioning gets taken care of in this old building and put their work in that area. Or if some people say, well, I'm going to make sure that people are cared for who are ill and people are not overlooked when they're sick, and they put their effort in on that area. That's the work that's necessary, the effort that's necessary in order to sustain what we do. It takes a certain amount of work and sacrifice. Carrie and I, 20 years ago when we first got married, had long discussions, and we keep having them over and over and over again. But we determined amongst ourselves, and this is, I'm not saying this because I want everybody else to do it or even think that everybody can or should, but we determined amongst ourselves we wanted to be generous people. Don't worry about her, she's fine. We wanted to be generous people, and that we wanted to make sure that we always were giving out more than we were taking in. We decided we're going to live in such a way that we can save 10% of our income, that we can give away 10% of our income, and that we can live on 80% of our income. For 20 years we've done that. And that means this year we gave away $6,000. $6,000 went to this church. Now, do I think that everybody needs to do that? No. Is it a sacrifice? Yes. And does it ever get easy? No. Every time it's time to get to the sit down and do your budgeting, you know, we sit down and look at our budget every couple months, and we look down there and we see, oh, so-and-so is going to this, and such is going this, and we see, oh, $1,000 every couple months going to the church. You know, we think, oh, wow, that $1,000 could be going to my child's education fund, or that $1,000 could be going to, you know, a big vacation in X or Y or Z. But because we're okay with the sacrifice entailed in being generous, we've decided we're going to do that. It never gets easy. It's always work. It's always an effort. But it's the effort that's necessary for us to do what we feel like we need to do in our particular situation in order to grow the garden of peace where we're at. Never gets easy. And so the third thing we see here real quick is that there's a certain amount of vigilance that's necessary in order to grow a garden. It says, and God built a watchtower in the midst of it. If you look down in verse 5, this is interesting too. He says, I will remove your hedge. I will remove your walls. So God, the gardener, had built a watchtower in the middle of the garden and hedges and walls around it. Now that's interesting. Why would you build a watchtower in the middle of the garden? Because you know things are going to try to get in there and eat your grapes. You know, the wild goats are going to try to get in there. They're going to try to devour the crop. And so we put hedges and walls about it, and it requires constant vigilance. And sometimes we forget about this. We think that gardening is just, you know, put it in the ground, and then you sit back and wait. Oh, look, whoa, there's crops later. That's not how it works. It takes the effort, and it takes the vigilance of continuing to go back and back and back and checking on it, making sure that there's nothing getting in there and destroying it. And I didn't do that this year. And because of that, the potato bugs, week after week after week, my potato plants started about like this, and they just kept going, chew, 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 until about 3 weeks later, you know, they were completely ravished by the potato bugs because I was not vigilant. And so you don't grow good gardens if you don't maintain vigilance, if you don't expect that adversity will come up and that conflict is going to erupt, and that shalom is not going to be able to stay there forever. And you just have to watch out for it and be prepared for it when it happens and put the work in necessary in order to get the stuff out of your garden. Now, you can apply this however you like, to the political realm, to the big world realm, to the personal realm. But the point is that adversity will come. In a world where shalom is not the usual order of business, remember in our tradition we think that we're in a fallen world. We're out of the Garden of Eden. In a world where right relationship is not the usual order of business, then keeping a garden of right relationship in your life, in the community life, in the world life, in the social sphere is going to be hard work because disruption and chaos is going to want to come in there and destroy that. It will surely come. Conflict will surely erupt. And this is not failure. Sometimes we think it's failure. It's just what happens. We should expect it, but we should have watchtowers to prevent that conflict from destroying the shalom that we've invested so much in. In my garden, I have to keep going back day after day to pick off those potato bugs. And in our nation, we have to keep going back to the polls year after year after year after year after year. And that's not going to stop. In our community, we have to continue to watch out for special interests trying to break up the shalom that we've managed to create. And in our homes and our personal lives, we have to constantly be listening to our own hearts and to the honest and loving words of others to make sure that we're always making those concrete decisions which lead to peace, because it's pretty likely that sometimes we're not going to do that. Vigilance. And then the last thing, and I'll be done, is that, and I think this is the most important thing, is that in growing a garden, we just have to face up to the fact that there is that which we have no control over. And isn't that the main point of this text? In this text, here God has planted the garden. God has been intentional about the wanting wine and making the decisions necessary to bear that wine. And then God has put the effort in order to ensure that that wine is going to be produced. And then God has been vigilant, has put up the watchtowers and put up those walls. And yet, what happened in this text? God asks for obedience from the people of Israel. and he does not, God does not get obedience. That obedience is not returned. And God has no control over the people of Israel about whether there's going to be obedience or whether there's not going to be obedience. And this is a deep wisdom, I think, that God, God's self, cannot control every single thing. How in the world do we think we're going to be able to control every single thing? There are a lot of us who plant our gardens with the impression that we're the ones who are making those gardens grow. That it's us who is really giving the life and bearing the fruit because of our work or our planning or our vigilance. And the fact is that we don't make the gardens grow ultimately, that we don't manage the process of photosynthesis in those leaves, right? That's a God thing. There is that over which we have no control. My potatoes this year were buffeted by too much early rain, as were probably many of yours. And every time it would start raining, I would think, please stop raining and destroy the garden. I have no control over that, you know? And there's a lot that we have no control over. We can't control the hours of sunlight in the day or the temperature of the air at night. We can't stop a swarm of locusts coming in and chewing everything down. And it is awfully good and right to acknowledge that the successes of our gardens, those successes aren't 100% due to our intentionality or our effort or our vigilance. And in fact, there would be no success in the garden and no shalom, but for the unforceable cooperation of a whole lot of other things over which we have absolutely no control. No farmer in his or her right mind will take 100% credit for a good yield. And in fact, in the Christian tradition, this is where we talk about grace. There's a certain grace that's necessary in order for anything to happen in a garden and in the gardens of our lives. It's self-flattery to think that we are creating the crops. And a mark of a good farmer is a deep humility in our garden tending and a proper acknowledgement of our own limits and a proper understanding that much of our life is a gift. And another reason this is important is shown very clearly in this Isaiah passage, because what's happening here is that there are often times in our lives where we put in the necessary work, the intentionality and the effort and the vigilance, and still what do we get? Sour grapes. Have you ever experienced that in your own life? It can be pretty devastating. If you feel like you've done all the right things and you've put in all this work and it's been very exhausting and you have made sacrifices and they have been real and it has felt hard, and what happens? Sour grapes. Things don't turn out well. And there's no shalom. And the temptation at times like that is to say, I failed, or even worse, I'm a failure. But does God say that in this passage about God's self? No. God acknowledges that there is that in the world which is beyond God's control. God needed the cooperativeness of the people of Israel in order for there to be good fruit in that land. And when there is no good fruit, that's not God's fault. It's not the farmer's fault. There are times in my life when I've done all the right things and I've sown a lot of good seed, you know, sow and you shall reap, and I didn't reap. And I got mad at God, because didn't God say, sow and you shall reap? Didn't I sow? Why am I not reaping? And I have to acknowledge, guess what? I don't control everything. And I don't have as much control over this all the time as I think I really do. Sometimes we get a bad harvest because we've sowed a little bad seed in there too. And we're reaping the weeds that we've sown in the patch of ground that has good seed in it as well. But sometimes part of our context has just not been able to respond to our work. And so what's the lesson there? That we're failures, that we should give up? No. It's that it takes grace to grow the garden of shalom. It's not something we have complete control over. It takes a gift of cooperation from the other parts of your system and of your nexus. And that sometimes is a cooperation you cannot, no matter how much you work, control. You cannot extract it as much as you'd want to. You just don't have control over everything. And it may help many of us out as parents and as workers in workplaces where there's conflict, or as members of social societies or groups where there's structural brokenness, or communities or towns or villages or states or nations where there's structural brokenness. And as inhabitants of an imperfect world, to remember the importance of grace and our inability to control every single thing. Process theologians talk about the importance of a fullness of time. And that's how they describe Jesus' catalytic work in the world and salvific work in the world. The same person might have come into play 150 years earlier than Jesus of Nazareth and said the same things that Jesus said and wouldn't have changed the world the way Jesus did because of the fullness of time that was necessary in order for that message to be heard. The same thing's true of Martin Luther King Jr., the same thing's true of any activist you can think of, that it required a fullness of time in order for a message to be heard. And those people had no control over that fullness of time. It was outside of their control. Some things can be done in certain places and in certain times and with certain people that can't be done at other places and other times and with other people. And it sometimes has nothing to do with us. And we can't let ourselves be discouraged because of it. It has everything to do with that which we cannot control. And yet we need to continue on the work of tending our garden, doing what we know we can do, of thinking ahead and being intentional, of putting in the effort and making the sacrifices, and of remaining vigilant. And if you don't do that, you're going to get stinky potatoes, for sure, which is just what I got this year. May we all be better gardeners, and I hope that you think to your new year, as we start a new school year, as a way of maybe thinking this image of how am I going to tend my garden of shalom this year. Let's pray. Oh God, help us to be humble gardeners and yet earnest ones as we try to till the fields of our lives, to recognize their bounds and limits, and yet at the same time to make the most of those lives that they can be, mirroring the peace you intend for us all. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.